It's 2010, Mobile World Congress in Barcelona. Eric Schmidt, who had been brought in as CEO in 2001 to add experienced management alongside founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin, walks onto a stage in front of thousands of telecom executives, the same people whose business models Google is about to destroy, and says, "Mobile is not the future, it is the present. Get mobile right or get left behind."
Backstage, Andy Rubin, a veteran mobile software engineer who'd previously co-founded Danger, the company behind the T-Mobile Sidekick and who's now running Android, is managing a team that's shipping an operating system to dozens of hardware manufacturers simultaneously. Samsung, HTC, Motorola, LG, Huawei. Each one needs a different configuration. Each one has different hardware. And the operating system they're all running was originally designed not for phones at all, but for digital cameras.
Android was supposed to make cameras smarter. It ended up making Google the operating system of the developing world. And the strategic logic behind that pivot, the reason Google gave away a mobile operating system for free, is one of the most elegant, defensive moves in the history of technology. Welcome back to Silicon Valley Strategy. I'm Myra D'Amico.
And I'm Travis Carlisle. This is Episode 9. So an operating system built for digital cameras that ended up on 3 billion phones. That's the kind of strategic accident that turns out to be the most important defensive move Google ever made.
And we're doing Google Part 2 today. Last episode, we covered the founding, PageRank, AdWords, and the IPO. Today, we pick up with the move to mobile, the acquisitions that worked, the social network that didn't, and the existential question facing Google in the AI era.
This is the episode where Google transitions from a search company to a platform company to an everything company, and where we start to see the tensions inherent in being a company whose primary revenue source is so profitable that it distorts every other strategic decision.
Before we get into it, trivia. Listeners, here's the question. Android was not originally designed for smartphones. When Google acquired Android Inc. in 2005, what was Andy Rubin's team actually building?
Good one.
Pause now if you want to guess. The answer, Andy Rubin's team was building an operating system for digital cameras. The idea was to give cameras smarter software, internet connectivity, better image processing, the ability to share photos directly from the device. The pitch to investors was that cameras needed better software, and a standardized operating system would enable that.
But before the acquisition closed, the team pivoted to mobile phones. The pivot was driven by the realization that the mobile phone market was much larger than the camera market, and that the same thesis, commodity hardware needs a smart operating system, applied even more powerfully to phones. The camera OS became a phone OS.
And here's the number that makes jaws drop. Google paid approximately $50 million for Android. $50 million for what became the operating system running on over 3 billion active devices worldwide.
To put that in perspective, $50 million is less than a Series A for a dating app today. Google bought the mobile operating system for the entire planet for less money than a pre-revenue startup raises to match people on their phones. If we're keeping track of the most lopsided acquisitions in technology history, this one has to be in the top three. We need to start a running list. $50 million for Android, $1.65 billion for YouTube. These numbers are absurd. Google might be the greatest acquirer in the history of capitalism.
That's actually painful to think about.
And both were defensive acquisitions. Google wasn't buying revenue, it was buying survival.
I want to note something about the trivia answer that's strategically important. The fact that Android started as a camera OS tells you that the technology wasn't designed around a specific use case. It was designed as a general purpose platform. And that generality is what made it possible to deploy it across hundreds of different phone manufacturers with radically different hardware. If Android had been purpose built for phones from the start, it might have been more tightly integrated with specific hardware, more like iOS. The camera heritage forced a level of hardware abstraction that turned out to be Android's greatest strategic asset.
That's a genuinely interesting observation. The bug, being designed for the wrong product, became the feature.
Exactly. Let's set the stage for the Android acquisition. It's 2005. What does the mobile landscape look like?
The smartphone, as we know it today, doesn't exist. The dominant mobile operating systems are Symbian, which runs most Nokia phones, and various proprietary systems from BlackBerry, Palm, and Microsoft's Windows Mobile. The iPhone is 2 years away. The typical mobile phone has a small screen, a physical keyboard, and runs carrier-controlled software. The internet experience on a mobile phone in 2005 is miserable.
And this is the strategic context for Google. Google's entire business, search advertising, depends on people having access to the internet. In 2005, internet access means a desktop or laptop computer with a web browser. If the future of computing is mobile, which is becoming increasingly obvious, and if the mobile operating system is controlled by Microsoft or Symbian or the carriers, then Google's access to the user is mediated by someone else. Someone who could at any time change the default search engine, block Google's services, or impose a tax on Google's revenue.
And this is where platform strategy becomes existential. In any computing paradigm, there's a stack: hardware, operating system, applications, services. Whoever controls the operating system layer controls distribution for everything above it. In the desktop era, Microsoft controlled the OS, and Microsoft used that control to distribute Internet Explorer, to bundle media players, to favor its own services. Google survived the desktop era because browsers were open and the web was neutral. But mobile was a new stack, and the OS layer was up for grabs.
Put yourself in Larry Page's shoes. You've built the most successful internet company in history. Your business prints money, literally, tens of billions of dollars a year in nearly pure profit. And you're looking at a platform shift, desktop to mobile, that could eliminate your access to the customer overnight if you don't control the mobile operating system.
The question isn't, can we make money from a mobile OS? The question is, can we survive without one? And the answer in 2005 is almost certainly no. If Microsoft's Windows Mobile becomes dominant, Google becomes a tenant. If the carriers control the software stack, Google becomes a toll road. The Android acquisition is a defensive move. It's not about making money from Android directly. It's about ensuring that Google's search business survives the transition to mobile. The operating system is the moat around the moat.
And the price, $50 million, is essentially free for a company of Google's size. The risk-reward calculus is extraordinary. If mobile doesn't take off, you've lost $50 million. A rounding error. If mobile takes over and you don't have an OS, you might lose your entire business.
This is one of the most asymmetric bets in corporate history, and it paid off by a factor of thousands.
It reminds me of the Fairchild founding, $10 bills on a table at the Clift Hotel. Small bets that reshape entire industries. The pattern of Silicon Valley history is asymmetric wagers made by people who see the future before the market prices it in.
And the people who don't make those bets, the George Bells, the carriers, the record labels, they end up as cautionary tales in podcasts like this one.
Which is incentive enough.
Google acquires Android Inc. in July 2005 for approximately $50 million. Andy Rubin's team joins Google and begins developing what will become Android as we know it, a mobile operating system that Google will give away for free to any hardware manufacturer that wants it.
And the give it away for free part is the strategic insight that everything else depends on. Because the question is, why would Google spend hundreds of millions of dollars developing an operating system and then not charge for it?
The answer is that Google doesn't need to make money from the operating system. Google makes money from search advertising. Every Android phone that ships with Google Search as the default, with Chrome as the default browser, with the Google Play Store pre-installed, every one of those phones is a distribution point for Google's core business. The operating system isn't the product. It's the distribution mechanism for the product.
And this is where the open versus closed platform strategy becomes the defining strategic question of the mobile era. Think about the two models. Apple builds iOS as a closed system. tightly integrated with its own hardware, controlled from top to bottom, distributed exclusively on iPhones. The advantage is quality. Apple controls every pixel of the experience. The disadvantage is reach. You only get iOS if you buy Apple hardware, which is expensive.
Google does the opposite. Android is open. Any manufacturer can use it, modify it, ship it on any hardware at any price point. The advantage is distribution. Android runs on everything from $1,000 Samsung flagships to $50 phones in rural India. The disadvantage is fragmentation. Google doesn't control the user experience on most Android devices. But Google doesn't need to control the experience. It needs to control the search bar. And on every Android phone, the search bar is Google.
And this is counterpositioning at its most devastating. Microsoft charges licensing fees for Windows Mobile. Symbian charges licensing fees. The carriers want to control the software and charge for that control. Google gives the OS away for free. The competitors can't match this because they need the licensing revenue. Microsoft can't give away Windows Mobile without destroying a revenue stream. The carriers can't give away control of the software without losing their power over the user experience. Google's model is structurally impossible for the incumbents to adopt. And distribution, giving the OS away, becomes the weapon, not the product itself, but the distribution of the product.
The result is explosive adoption. By 2008, the first Android phone ships, the T-Mobile G1, made by HTC. By 2010, Android is on dozens of devices from dozens of manufacturers. By 2013, Android has over 80% global smartphone market share. Symbian is dead, BlackBerry is dying, Windows Phone is irrelevant.
And here's the thing that I think is strategically fascinating. Android didn't win the premium market. The iPhone won the premium market. Apple sells phones at an average selling price of around $800 and captures the vast majority of smartphone industry profits. Android won the volume market, the developing world, the price-sensitive consumer, the billions of people for whom a $100 smartphone is their first internet device.
And for Google's purposes, volume is what matters. Google doesn't need Android users to be wealthy. It needs them to be online. A farmer in India searching Google on a $100 Android phone generates search advertising revenue, just like a banker in Manhattan searching on a $1,000 iPhone. The revenue per user is lower, but the number of users is vastly higher. 3 billion active Android devices versus roughly 1.5 billion active Apple devices.
And together, this is remarkable when you step back. The iPhone and Android created one of the most effective duopolies in technology history. Together, they eliminated every other mobile operating system. And they did it from opposite ends of the market. Apple from the top, Google from the bottom. Converging in the middle until there was no room left for anyone else.
I mean, what's wild is that Apple and Google achieved total market dominance while running completely opposite strategies. Apple charges a premium and controls everything. Google gives it away and controls nothing except the services layer. They're philosophically incompatible, and together they're unbeatable. It's like a pincer movement, and each side of the pincer made the other side stronger, because the more Apple pushed premium, the more the rest of the market needed a free alternative, and the more Android dominated volume, the more Apple could differentiate on quality.
The strategic odd couple. And this created enormous switching costs for the hardware manufacturers. Samsung, Xiaomi, Oppo, Vivo, they all ship Android with Google's suite of services. Google Search, Chrome, Gmail, Google Maps, YouTube, the Play Store. If an OEM wanted to switch to a different operating system, they'd lose access to all of these services. And without Google's services, particularly the Play Store, the phone is dramatically less useful.
Huawei learned this the hard way when it was cut off from Google services. Huawei had the hardware capability to build excellent phones, but without the Google Play Store, without Gmail, without Google Maps, sales outside China collapsed. The hardware was fine, the ecosystem was missing.
So the OEMs are locked in. But the lock-in is asymmetric. It's relatively easy for Google to add a new OEM to the Android ecosystem. It's enormously difficult for an OEM to leave. The golden handcuffs are genuinely golden. And that connects to Google's other genius acquisition, which was playing out in parallel. In October 2006, Google acquires YouTube for $1.65 billion. YouTube has 65 employees, it has enormous traffic and approximately zero revenue. It also has an existential legal problem. The vast majority of content on the platform has been uploaded without the copyright holder's permission.
The copyright lawsuits were immediate and massive. Viacom, the media conglomerate that owned MTV, Comedy Central, and Paramount, sued Google for $1 billion in 2007, claiming that YouTube hosted over 150,000 unauthorized clips of Viacom content, clips from The Daily Show, SpongeBob, MTV programming. The entertainment industry saw YouTube the same way the music industry had seen Napster, a massive copyright violation machine that happened to be popular.
And Google's survival strategy had two components. The legal component was DMCA Safe Harbor, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act provision that protects platforms from liability for user-uploaded content, as long as the platform removes infringing content when notified. Google argued that YouTube was a platform, not a publisher, and that it complied with takedown requests.
But the more important component, the one that actually resolved the business conflict, was Content ID. Google invested hundreds of millions of dollars in building a system that could automatically identify copyrighted content in uploaded videos. When Content ID detects a copyrighted song or video clip, it gives the copyright holder three options: block the video, track the video's viewership data, or monetize the video by running ads and collecting the revenue.
And option three, monetize, is what saved YouTube. The copyright holders realized that instead of playing whack-a-mole with takedown requests, they could let the infringing content stay up and collect advertising revenue from it. A fan-uploaded clip of a music video might generate thousands of views. Instead of paying lawyers to remove it, the record label could run ads against it and make money. The infringement became a revenue stream. Google took the conflict between platform scale and copyright enforcement and turned it into a partnership.
By 2023, YouTube is generating approximately $30 billion in annual advertising revenue. The copyright holders are collecting billions from Content ID. The creators are building careers on the platform. And the 65-employee startup that Google bought for $1.65 billion is worth, by most analyst estimates, somewhere between $300 and $400 billion as a standalone entity.
$1.65 billion to $300 billion. That's the Android playbook again. Acquire something that looks like a problem and turn it into a platform.
And remember, this is 2006. The dot-com crash was only 5 years earlier. Most companies were still terrified of overpaying for anything on the internet. Google pays $1.65 billion for a company drowning in lawsuits with zero revenue, and it turns out to be the best acquisition of the decade. Sometimes the best investments look like the worst ideas.
The dot-com lesson cuts both ways. Don't overpay for hype, but also don't underpay for the future because the present looks scary.
Which actually brings us to the one area where Google's playbook completely broke down. And this is where distribution as a weapon, the strategy that won Android, that won YouTube, that won search, hits its limits. In June 2011, Google launches Google Plus. It's the company's most ambitious attempt to compete with Facebook in social networking. It's backed by the full resources of the company. Larry Page, who's just reassumed the CEO role from Eric Schmidt, makes Google Plus a company-wide priority. Employee bonuses are reportedly tied to the success of social initiatives.
And the launch strategy is the most aggressive distribution play Google has ever attempted. Google doesn't just build a standalone social network. It integrates Google Plus into everything. YouTube comments require a Google Plus account. Gmail shows Google Plus notifications. Google search results include Google Plus posts. This is what people inside Google called the plusification, the systematic embedding of Google Plus into every Google product.
Now, here's where I want to slow down, because the Google Plus strategy was explicitly built on the premise that distribution is the weapon, the same premise that made Android work. The logic was, Google has over a billion Gmail users, over a billion YouTube users, over a billion search users. If we require all of them to create Google Plus accounts, we'll have the largest social network in the world overnight. Distribution conquers all.
And it did, technically. Google Plus forced hundreds of millions of Gmail users to create accounts. At its peak, Google reported over 500 million Google Plus users. And that number was technically accurate. Hundreds of millions of people had Google Plus accounts. The problem was that almost none of them used Google Plus for anything resembling social networking. They created accounts because YouTube required it. They didn't return because there was no compelling social experience.
And this is the most important failure in Google's history, because it reveals the limit of the distribution strategy. Distribution can put an operating system on 3 billion phones. Distribution can make YouTube the default video destination. But distribution cannot force people to have genuine social interactions on a platform they don't care about. The open versus closed platform strategy works when the product is infrastructure, an OS, a browser, a video player. It fails when the product is the social connections. You can distribute software, you can't distribute friendship.
And this failure didn't come cheap. Before Google Plus, Google had already stumbled with Google Buzz in 2010, a social layer bolted onto Gmail that automatically shared users' email contacts as a public social network. The privacy backlash was immediate and severe. People discovered that their therapists, their ex-partners, their lawyers were being publicly listed as their contacts. The FTC settlement over Google Buzz cost Google over $1 billion in fines and consent decrees. $1 billion. For a social product that lasted less than 2 years.
$1 billion. For a product nobody asked for that publicly exposed people's private relationships, that's not a product launch. That's a privacy disaster with a marketing budget.
And yet Google doubled down with Google Plus just 1 year later. The Buzz debacle should have taught Google something fundamental about social networking, that it's not an engineering problem with a measurable quality metric. It's a human problem that requires understanding context, trust, and the messiness of real relationships.
Google's core competency is organizing information. Search is information retrieval. Maps is geographic information. Gmail is email information. YouTube is video information. In every case, the task is take a large amount of information and organize it algorithmically so users can find what they need. Social networking is fundamentally different. Social isn't about organizing information. It's about navigating human relationships. And human relationships are messy, contextual, emotional, and resistant to algorithmic organization.
Facebook understood this intuitively. Zuckerberg built a product around the social graph, the web of relationships between people. The algorithm served content based on who you knew and what they shared. Google tried to organize social interactions the same way it organized web pages, with structure, with categories, with circles that let you sort your contacts into groups. It was an engineer's solution to a human problem.
By 2015, Google began dismantling the mandatory integrations. Google Plus was officially shut down in April 2019. And here's the Seven Powers lens on why. Social networking is fundamentally a network economy. The product is valuable because your friends are on it. Google couldn't replicate Facebook's network effect because the network effect is the product. You can't bootstrap a social network with technology alone. You need the people. And the people were already on Facebook. Facebook's social graph was a cornered resource, and Google couldn't replicate it.
What gets me about Google Plus is that it represents the limit of Google's competence. Google can beat anyone at information retrieval. It can build the best search engine, the best maps product, the best email client. But social isn't information retrieval. And the organizational culture, the engineering mentality, the algorithmic approach that makes Google dominant in information, all of that works against it in social. Your greatest strength defines your greatest limitation.
Now, while Google Plus was failing, a quieter but strategically more important story was unfolding. Google was systematically building products to defend search against vertical competitors, companies that could disintermediate Google in specific categories: Google Maps, Google Shopping, Google Flights. Each one keeps queries within Google's ecosystem that might otherwise leak to a vertical competitor.
And then in 2015, the Alphabet restructuring. Google reorganizes itself into Alphabet Inc., a holding company, with Google as the primary subsidiary, and the other bets, Waymo, Verily, DeepMind, Wing, Calico as separate entities.
But the strategic logic is deeper than transparency. The moonshots, particularly Waymo for autonomous vehicles and DeepMind for artificial intelligence, are funded by the surplus from search advertising. And the reason Google funds them is existential. If AI disrupts search, Google needs to be the one doing the disrupting.
And before we get to the AI dilemma, I want to talk about something that most analysis of Google completely misses, because it reframes the entire competitive picture. Google's custom silicon, the TPUs, Tensor Processing Units.
This is the thing that changes the math on everything. So here's the background. Since 2015, Google has been designing its own custom AI chips, TPUs, manufactured by Broadcom. Google trained the original Transformer model on TPUs. It trained Gemini on TPUs. It runs the vast majority of its AI inference on TPUs. Google has been running custom AI silicon for over a decade. That's not a hedge. That's a structural cost advantage that nobody else in the industry has at this scale.
And the cost difference is staggering. Here's the arithmetic. NVIDIA charges roughly 80% gross margins on its GPUs. That's approximately a 5-to-1 markup over the cost of the silicon. Google's TPUs are manufactured by Broadcom at approximately a 2-to-1 markup, around 50% gross margin for Broadcom. That means Google is paying roughly 2.5 times less per dollar of compute silicon than a company buying NVIDIA GPUs. 2.5 times less. In a world where AI infrastructure costs hundreds of billions of dollars, that's not a rounding error. That's a structural moat.
And it gets better. NVIDIA builds general-purpose GPUs. They're designed to handle any AI workload from any customer. Google's TPUs are custom-designed for exactly Google's workloads. No wasted transistors. No unnecessary features. Every gate on the chip is optimized for the specific computations Google needs. It's the difference between buying a Swiss Army knife and commissioning a custom surgical instrument.
Now let's think about what this means strategically. The dominant narrative about Google and AI is defensive. Google is a search advertising company desperately trying to protect its ad revenue from AI disruption. AI overviews cost 10 times more per query to serve than traditional search results. The margins are compressing. Google is cannibalizing itself. That's the story Wall Street tells.
But the TPU cost advantage inverts that narrative. If Google's cost per unit of AI compute is 2.5 times lower than its competitors, lower than OpenAI running on Microsoft Azure, lower than Anthropic running on Amazon or Google Cloud, lower than anyone buying NVIDIA at 80% margins, then Google can afford to do things that nobody else can afford to do. Google can give away AI features in search without destroying margins, because the compute costs less. Google Cloud can offer competitive AI pricing against AWS and Azure while maintaining healthy margins. The self-cannibalization is going to kill Google thesis assumes Google has the same cost structure as everyone else. It doesn't.
Google may have the lowest cost of AI compute of any company on Earth. And in an industry where the primary constraint is the cost of running AI models at scale, being the low-cost provider isn't a defensive position. It's an offensive weapon. This isn't Google desperately defending search. This is Google potentially positioned to win the AI era on cost structure alone, the same way Amazon won e-commerce by being willing to operate at margins nobody else could survive.
The Walmart of AI compute. I didn't expect that to be Google's play, but the math doesn't lie.
And that's the reframe that I think most analysts are missing. The standard story is Google is desperately defending search from AI disruption. But look at the cost structure. Broadcom charges Google roughly a 2-to-1 markup on TPU silicon, about 50% margin. NVIDIA charges its customers a 5-to-1 markup, 80% margin. Google is paying 2.5 times less per dollar of compute than anyone buying NVIDIA. That's not a company playing defense. That's a company with a structural cost weapon that lets it give away AI features while competitors bleed margin trying to match it.
It completely inverts the narrative. Google trained Gemini on its own TPUs. It runs AI overviews on its own TPUs. It can afford to embed AI into every single product, search, Gmail, Docs, Maps, because its cost per inference is a fraction of what OpenAI or Anthropic pays on rented cloud GPUs. Everyone else is renting compute at NVIDIA's 80% margin. Google is building at Broadcom's 50% margin. That's not defending search. That's playing offense with the lowest cost of AI compute on Earth.
Google doesn't need AI to be cheap for everyone. It just needs AI to be cheaper for Google than for anyone else. And right now it is, by a factor of 2.5.
That might be the most underpriced advantage in the entire technology industry right now.
Now let's talk about the other bets, because one of them deserves far more attention than it gets. Waymo, Google's autonomous vehicle subsidiary.
Forbes estimates Waymo at a $1 trillion opportunity. A trillion. And we've barely mentioned it. Waymo is operating commercially in multiple cities, San Francisco, Phoenix, Los Angeles, running fully autonomous rides without safety drivers. No other company is doing this at Waymo's scale. Cruise pulled back. Apple canceled its car project entirely. Tesla's full self-driving is still technically level 2. It requires driver supervision. Waymo is running level 4 autonomy, no human driver, in commercial service today.
Think about what that means. Google's largest non-advertising bet is potentially a second business the size of Google's entire current ad revenue. If autonomous vehicles become the dominant mode of urban transportation, robotaxis replacing car ownership, autonomous delivery, autonomous trucking, the platform that runs the fleet captures an enormous share of the value. Waymo isn't a moonshot that might pay off in 20 years. It's a commercially operational service that's scaling now, and Google has funded it with the surplus from search advertising for over a decade. That's the kind of long-term investment that only a company with Google's cash flow can sustain.
And this is where the Alphabet restructuring starts to look genuinely brilliant in hindsight. Separating Waymo from Google proper allowed it to operate with startup-like focus while being funded with monopoly-level resources. The search advertising business isn't just defending itself. It's funding what could be the next $100 billion business, maybe multiple.
And to put a number on it, Forbes estimates Waymo as a $1 trillion opportunity. A trillion. If autonomous vehicles become the default mode of urban transportation, robo-taxis, autonomous delivery, autonomous trucking, the platform operator captures an extraordinary share of the value chain. Waymo is commercially operational today and no competitor is close. Cruise pulled back, Apple canceled its car project. That's not a moonshot anymore. That's a monopoly in formation.
A $1 trillion option, funded for over a decade by search advertising profits, with no credible competitor at scale. If Waymo were a standalone company, it would be the most valuable startup on Earth, and it's sitting inside Alphabet as an other bet that most investors barely think about.
And that brings us to the biggest question in this entire episode. The innovator's dilemma in real time. Google's search advertising business generates over $150 billion a year. Any technology that threatens to make the search box obsolete, conversational AI, direct answers, agent-based computing, threatens that entire revenue stream. But if Google doesn't invest in those technologies, someone else will build them, and Google dies anyway.
The question is whether you can disrupt yourself. And the history of technology suggests that it's extraordinarily difficult. The incentives within the organization always favor protecting the existing business. Clayton Christensen, the Harvard Business School professor who coined the Innovator's Dilemma framework, wrote the book on this. And the book says, incumbents almost always lose.
Almost always, but not always.
Not always. And Google has more resources, more talent, and more data than any company that's ever faced this dilemma. Plus, and this is the part that changes the calculus, it has a structural cost advantage in AI compute that nobody else has. The innovator's dilemma is hardest when the new technology is less profitable than the old one. But if Google's cost of AI compute is 2.5 times lower than its competitors, the new technology might not be less profitable. It might be a different kind of profitable, one that Google is uniquely positioned to capture.
I'll say this. If any company in history has the resources to survive the innovator's dilemma, it's Google. It has the data, the distribution, the talent, and now we see it may have the cost structure too. But resources alone have never been sufficient. IBM had resources. Nokia had resources. Kodak invented the digital camera. The dilemma isn't about what you have. It's about what you're willing to sacrifice.
And that's the question. What is Google willing to sacrifice? Although, and this is the optimistic read, maybe the TPU cost advantage means Google doesn't have to sacrifice as much as everyone assumes. Maybe the AI transition isn't the margin-destroying catastrophe the bears predict. Maybe it's a transition where Google's structural advantages actually get stronger, not weaker.
You know, these distinctions between network effects, cornered resources, and counterpositioning, they're exactly what the online course at svstrategy.exyz is designed to teach. It has a 7 powers analysis tool, era context for every decade, and mystery company simulations where you evaluate companies using these exact frameworks. That's SV, short for Silicon Valley, strategy.xyz.
SVstrategy.xyz, a good way to level up your strategic thinking.
Let's land this. Takeaways from Google Part 2. And I want to draw out the explicit frameworks here because this episode has 3 strategic concepts that generalize well beyond Google.
Framework 1, and this is the big one from the Android story, open versus closed platform strategy and distribution as a competitive weapon. The analytical question is, when does giving the product away for free constitute an unbeatable strategy, and when does it fail? The answer depends on whether the product is infrastructure or experience. Android succeeded because the operating system is infrastructure. Users don't care who made it, they care what it runs. Google gave away infrastructure to control the distribution of its real product, which is search. Google Plus failed because social networking is experience. Users don't want distributed software, they want their friends. You can weaponize distribution when the product is a pipe. You can't weaponize distribution when the product is a community.
And the corollary, if your competitor gives the product away for free, you can't compete on the product. You have to compete on something else. Microsoft couldn't compete with Android on price. Apple competed on quality and vertical integration. Everyone else died. Counterpositioning, the free model that incumbents can't adopt without destroying their revenue, is one of the most powerful strategic moves available, but only when distribution is what matters.
Framework 2, the limits of organizational competence. Your greatest strength defines your greatest limitation. Google's algorithmic brilliance is why it dominates search, maps, and information organization. It's also why it failed at social networking. The organizational culture that optimizes for measurable, quantifiable outcomes is ill-equipped to build products that depend on messy, unquantifiable human dynamics. And this generalizes. Every company has a core competency that also defines its core limitation. The trick is knowing where your competency ends and a different competency begins.
And framework 3, defensive acquisitions as the highest return investments a company can make. Android for $50 million and YouTube for $1.65 billion are 2 of the most valuable acquisitions in corporate history. In both cases, Google wasn't buying a revenue stream, it was buying a defensive position, control of a platform that in hostile hands could have threatened the core business. The lesson. When evaluating acquisitions, the question isn't just what revenue does this generate, it's what revenue does this protect.
Framework 4, cost structure as strategic weapon. The TPU story reframes Google from a company defending search to a company potentially playing a fence in the AI era. Google designs custom TPUs manufactured by Broadcom at roughly 50% margins. NVIDIA charges 80% margins. Google pays approximately 2.5 times less per dollar of AI compute than anyone buying NVIDIA hardware. In an era where every company is spending tens of billions on AI infrastructure, being the low-cost provider of compute is an enormous structural advantage. It means Google can afford to give away AI features in search, in cloud, in workspace that competitors can't offer at the same economics. The standard narrative says Google is defensively protecting ad revenue from AI disruption. The cost structure tells a different story. Google may be uniquely positioned to win the AI transition because it can afford to run AI at a cost nobody else can match.
And framework 5, Waymo as the hidden option. Forbes estimates Waymo at a $1 trillion opportunity. Google has funded autonomous vehicle research for over a decade with search advertising profits. Waymo is now operating commercially, fully autonomous rides, no safety driver in multiple cities. No competitor is close. This is potentially a second business the size of Google's entire advertising revenue, funded by the patience that only a monopoly profit business can sustain. The lesson: when your core business generates enormous surplus, the strategic question isn't just how to defend that business, it's how to deploy the surplus into bets that could become equally large. Google's other bets aren't distractions from the core business. They're the dividends of monopoly economics, reinvested into the future.
And the overarching lesson that ties all five frameworks together: the innovator's dilemma is real, and awareness doesn't solve it. Google knows that AI might replace the search box. Google is investing billions in AI, but the organizational gravity of a $150 billion search business pulls resources and attention toward protecting the existing model. The question is whether Google can navigate this dilemma, whether it can disrupt itself before someone else does. And the answer may be more optimistic than the conventional wisdom suggests, because Google has something no previous incumbent facing the innovator's dilemma has had: a structural cost advantage in the very technology that's doing the disrupting, a $1 trillion option in Waymo, and the largest AI user base on the planet. Whether that's enough remains the most important strategic question in technology today.
And we won't know the answer for another decade, but the evidence increasingly suggests that the "Google is doomed" narrative may be as wrong as the "Google is just a search engine" narrative was in 2004.
Throughlines. Throughline 4. Android is the purest sequenced leverage play in the course. Give away the OS, control the defaults, monetize the search. And Throughline 6. Acquisition as competitive strategy. YouTube for $1.65 billion. Everyone called it insane. It was the best acquisition Google ever made. Before we go, if you want to explore the Android acquisition, the YouTube deal, and Google's defensive strategy in more depth, the online course at svstrategy.xyz has the full podcast transcripts with section navigation, plus interactive quizzes that test whether you can spot defensive versus offensive acquisitions. That's svstrategy.xyz.
svstrategy.xyz. Next time, Amazon Part 1. Jeff Bezos, the regret minimization framework, and the company that decided to operate at zero profit for 20 years on purpose.
The longest game in the history of capitalism. See you next time.